So tonight I'm going to speak a little bit about the process of Zen practice and start by saying that the literature in Zen and all the books on Zen and all the things that we can talk about and all the teachings I've given and Richard's given certainly seem on the surface to have a lot of complexity. Seems to be so much to like get all together to grasp. But it's actually way simpler than that. One way you could describe it, the essence of what we're doing, is that there is nothing in particular to realize. There's nothing in particular to realize. There's nothing in particular to know. There's nothing in particular to understand. Matter of fact, to go through what we call realizing, to grasp some understanding, is to, in a way, be going in the wrong direction. So I like to think of this process as learning to go to the very core of yourself, the very heart of yourself, the very deepest center. There are things that stop us from going to that center, and they have to do with our way of trying to understand ourselves, to change ourselves, to react to the sensory inputs that we experience, not just in our everyday life, where we have to live in a map in a virtual world in order to get along and to survive. But when we talk about this particular practice, which is much more practice of reality, the other world is a practice of learning skills, learning how to manipulate the world, learning how to get along with people, learning how to navigate from point A to point B, learning various models that are very, very powerful and very helpful, including science. Science is a model. It's a very powerful model. But science stops at a certain point. It can't explain certain things beyond itself. And when it tries to think that it does, it becomes what is called reductionistic. Like everything can be reduced to some tiny little particle. The latest rage, which is probably a passing rage or only bought into by a limited number of physicists, is the one of string theory, which is if you broke everything down, you smashed it down to the tiniest thing, you end up with little bits of vibrating string, and that creates the entire universe. Now, there's two problems with this. There's an explanation for everything. One problem is you don't really know what a string is. You don't know what its substance is. And also you have absolutely no idea where it came from. Now it couldn't come out of thin air. Some physicists maybe do think that you could have a void and then something can suddenly appear, but this is all in the realm of model making. It's very powerful. It's what creates smartphones. It's what creates television. It's what creates automobiles and all the technologies that allow us to survive in this world and also perhaps begin to destroy this world with global warming, etc. But Zen is going in a different direction. It's not, at least initially, not looking out. Not initially looking out. Later in your practice, you learn to take what you learn from the deep inner practice and apply it to the everyday world, plunging into your everyday world and understanding this world of what's called differentiation, all the little different things that appear in our lives. But the practice that we have to do, our core practice, is to go underneath differentiation. Underneath all of our models, underneath all of our assumptions to a very deep place, a center. Now, the reason that I say it's not about realizing any particular thing or understanding any particular thing or set of things is that anything you can realize as particular, anything you can know, anything you can understand, is your object. It's not invalid. But as long as you're looking out, you cannot get to your center. So this is the paradox of how we approach our lives. What we so need to do and what is so rare in this world is to just go to your center. Hang out there. Get to know it very intimately. Get very comfortable with it. Go there to restore yourself. And not just that, but to understand what you really are down below all your assumptions. And when you understand that, you simultaneously, and this is the miraculous thing, you understand all sentient beings. So the appearances in the world differ in each center. What I'm experiencing right now is utterly different than what each of you are experiencing in your center. There's some similarities. We hear a voice speaking. We see a similar room. But each of us sees it from our own angle, our own perspective. And we don't see what others right around us out in the street are experiencing. Every center of the universe has its own unique configuration. But what is its substance? What is its core? You might say, what is its source? If you go to your very center and you hang out there and you get to know it really well, you begin to understand that your source, the core of reality, the substance of which all these apparent separate entities are made, is one spacious thing. One space. This, I feel, is where love comes from, and empathy and compassion, is when you understand that your deepest self, not the superficial things, not even the things that you hold very dear and close and private, but the deepest self is the one that already resonates, gets it, understands. You look in the eyes of another person and you get it. You see that space in them. And the more you can get comfortable with the space in yourself, the more you can feel compassion. So compassion is an outcome of this practice, not an aim, so to speak. As I've said before, if you aim for anything in this practice, including peace of mind, enlightenment, whatever it might be, you're constantly looking outward. You're trying to find this thing that you're aiming for. And you're going in the wrong direction. So Zazen is a set of techniques, not to understand something and not to know something, but to take you to this center. We start with our actual experience. So we start with breath, for example, or a count, or a koan, or shikantaza, which is just starting with your sensory experience. And we learn to detach thinking from the raw experience. We detach it without getting rid of it. This is really important. We don't stop thoughts. We just don't see the thoughts as having anything to do with the raw experience. It's just another piece of experience. So there's a smell of incense. There might be a thought about the incense. But the thought about the incense is a thought about incense. It's not the incense. You may experience an emotion, and then you may judge the emotion. It means such and thus about yourself. But as you get more clear in your Zazen practice, you begin to very clearly see that there's an emotion and there's a thought about the emotion. They're not the same. The thought about the emotion is not the emotion. So we begin to see very clearly the actual sensory experience. We begin to become, as I have said before, dispassionate. we understand that the sensory experience is part of a fabric of space-time. We can't really control that very much. We control a little bit. I can open my eyes wider, open them smaller. But whatever I see is part of the fabric of space-time. I can't right now in my zazen make any radical change in that. And I'm not interested in it because it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it comes one way or another way. Why is it irrelevant? It's irrelevant when you strip off its meaning and its value and its hierarchy and how it relates to anything else. When you're just experiencing it as raw experience, its particularities become irrelevant. So this is another very critical part of Zazen, is to begin to see the irrelevancy of all the things we make important in our everyday life. What do I mean by irrelevant? They're not irrelevant to your life, but they're irrelevant to reality. Reality meaning your actual experience before you make any ideas about it, before you hold on to all the things you learned and all the things you know. You begin to see things in a very raw way, a very stark way. That's the beginning of Zazen. So, for example, we have people count their breath. It's because one has no meaning, two has no meaning, etc., etc. The breath itself has no meaning. It's very easy to now see this and focus on it and observe it and strip off any meaning to it. You don't say, this is a good breath and that is a bad breath. I want this breath, I don't want that breath. So we begin to just see that our sensory experience comes very innocently, very freshly, and it's not divided from the whole fabric. It's confluent with the fabric. It only seems divided when we think about it, when we make it separate. Now we begin to get something deeper. We begin to get that there's something. Something is presenting that is not the particularity. Now in Zen there's a term for it. It's called mind with a capital M, or shin, which really means heart-mind, which is a wonderful, wonderful word. So this heart-mind means that it is not outside you. What seems to be opposing you, your sensory experience, it seems out there, is actually so intimate. It's unique only to you. Only you really know it. When you're counting one or two, no one else knows that number. No one else knows exactly how that number sounds in your mind at that moment. It is absolutely intimate. So you begin to understand that although the configuration of the sound varies from moment to moment because everything is constantly changing, there's something that is the same about it, which is that it is intimate. It is you. It is your mind. Now this word shin, a Japanese word shin, Chinese has a word for it. Its translation in the pictogram really means more than just mind, because we as Westerners tend to think of mind as a thinking organ, a thinking capacity, or a space within which something's happening. But this is heart mind. It's the very core. It's the heart of reality. This is what we're going to in our zazen. This is what we're pointing at. So we're learning how to observe very clearly. Notice that thoughts are just thoughts, that they seem to arise in response to sensory experiences. But we are very clear that they're thoughts. So we talk about these, the six consciousnesses of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. We see them all as just different dharmas, meaning sensory experiences. You actually sense your thoughts. You hear, feel, think them. You smell the incense. But you smell the incense in your center. You think the thought in your center. You hear the sound in your center. Only you know it. So we begin to sink down into our center. And we begin to get curious about that center. The way the forms come becomes less and less important or meaningful in our zazen. It's there as a vehicle, as a tool, and as a manifestation of this mind. But we get very curious about what is this mind? What is the substance of these thoughts, feelings, smells, sights? So we begin to point this light of the mind in on itself. This is the way our zazen progresses as we get better and better at just focusing and going deep inside. When we start to look in that direction, we do see something. We see something that we have a name for. We call it me. And as we begin, just as we do with sensory things, to detach the thoughts about me from this me, we begin to see the me as an experience. It itself is a dharma. It's deeper than the thoughts. It seems to be deeper than the smells. It's like the ground. It's this intimate. We name it me, and we give characteristics to it, and it becomes a, quote, self. But as we get smarter and smarter in our zazen, it goes deeper and deeper. We begin to understand that the characteristics that we apply to this me are just characteristics. They're just figures of speech, so to speak. The Diamond Sutra went into this very deeply, about the characteristics of the Buddha being just the characteristics. They're not what the Buddha is. And the Buddha is just you yourself, me, myself. The Buddha was a human being who was able superbly to look in this direction. So we begin to see this purity of an intimate place. And then we can say, what is it that knows this? This is the beginning of pointing this light of the mind in on itself. And now it's like a bottomless dark pool. Here's where knowing doesn't help you anymore. Knowing would be looking at something as your object. You have to become the subject. It's very deep and very profound. And very, very simple. Very direct. You can go there immediately. You don't have to take any time to go there. But it's so simple that any idea about it, any picture of it in your mind, becomes an object and you're pointing in the wrong direction again. So it's really, really subtle. So a lot of what teachers try to teach is how to go in this direction. First of all, how to detach from the struggles with the sensory world that keep you floating by saying the way things are presenting right now, part of a fabric of space-time, they had to be this way right now. And as I pointed out during the session that we just had, by the time you become aware of something, it's happened. It's actually done. That all has to do with the speed of light, that there's a limiting speed. It's not instantaneous. So when you experience something, it's not like right then and there, the karma of it just happened. Everything that led up to it, to your awareness of it, it had already been configured that way. There's no going back and changing it. So we begin to just see it in a more neutral, dispassionate way. So we're not hung up on that level and we can begin to go to these deeper levels of mind. So when we do this, knowing is no longer helping us. Knowing is getting in our way. Knowing is this objective looking out. We have to go to not knowing. You actually have to begin to appreciate, to love, to enter not knowing, this deep not knowing. This is, I spoke with a new student tonight about this path not being a path of belief, and it's exactly what I'm saying right now, that any kind of knowing, particularly the knowing that gets involved with religious and spiritual endeavors, very often solidifies into beliefs, and they get stuck. And they're just your object, and you can't go in the direction you need to go in your zazen. So to go in that direction, you are carried by your not knowing. You are transported by your not knowing. So when you don't know, and you become comfortable with not knowing, and you realize how precious not knowing is, you're beginning to go in the direction that you need to get to the center. Now just read a koan out of the Hekigan Roku, which is a collection of 100 koan. These are teaching stories. This is the very first koan in the book, and I think it's not a mistake that this is the very first koan. So this koan's title is Bodhidharma's I Don't Know. And I'll just read the whole case. It's a little bit long, about half a page. I'll just read it. So Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, who was incidentally the what we call the first Zen patriarch. He was the historical or mythical, I'm not really sure which, individual who brought Buddhism from India to China. And in China it became Chan, and when it moved to Japan it became Zen. And because that word is so easy to pronounce, we adopted it when it finally came to the West. And Zen or Chan simply means absorption. It comes from the Sanskrit word dhyana. So this is Bodhidharma's I Don't Know. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? See how he's trying to know, he's trying to understand. Bodhidharma said, emptiness without holiness. The emperor said, who's standing before me? The implication being, well, I thought you were a holy man from India. Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. I don't know. This could be the only koan in the book. This could be the only koan that you ever need to study. I don't know. Who are you? I don't know. Remember now, Bodhidharma did Zazen for 9 years facing a wall after he left Emperor Wu. He left. He didn't come back. He decided he wanted no students, he didn't want to do any teaching. He sat in Zazen and went into I don't know profoundly, till finally one student said, you must teach me. So I'll go on with the story. The emperor did not understand what he just said. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei, and that's where he purportedly sat for 9 years. Later, the emperor brought this up to Prince Qi, who is a pretty smart, savvy guy, who asked, does your majesty know who this man is? The emperor said, I don't know. It's a different kind of I don't know. Prince Qi said, he is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. The emperor felt regretful and wanted to send an emissary to invite Bodhidharma to return. Prince Qi told him, your majesty, it is no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still would not return. It's another subtle aspect of this koan. Why would he not return? Why? Why do you need Bodhidharma? Why do you need anything outside yourself? This I don't know is your deepest self. You don't need Bodhidharma. He doesn't need to come back. So this is one of the deep implications of this koan. But this is really the heart of Zen, is adopting, embracing, entering this not knowing. So that's all I wanted to say tonight, and I would really like to open it up to comments or questions, and including, like, how do I get to that place? If you do have a question. If you don't, you don't have to ask anything.
Take you away from where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so you become your thoughts,
mm-hmm.
in a way, and you're distracted by your thoughts. And then, so you're the So the who you are is who's thinking the thoughts. But is it the process sort of like I'm sort of getting to the point where I'm sort of almost humored by my thoughts.
Well, one thing that you're demonstrating, and it's a very, very good question, is how complicated thought gets. Because what you're engaging in now is trying to figure it out, which is totally understandable. So what does Zen teach us about it? One comment made in Zen is the thought of continuation should be cut short. There's no problem at all with a thought. It's just following that thought with another thought, thinking about the thought, about that thought, and then it carries you on and on and on. It creates a world that is pulling you out, creating a solid confrontation, getting you embroiled. Then the clinging to one thing, rejecting it, all the ideas that get applied to the innocent world it's presenting begin to surround you and encapsulate you. So, when a thought arises, when a sound happens, when a feeling in your body happens, an emotion happens, even in your everyday life, because this moves from our zazen where we do it intently as a laboratory, we bring it into our life so that we begin to live in a little different way with some more dispassion. We begin to understand that whatever's presenting already happened. The thought has already happened. The sound has happened. I heard it. The smell happened. So I don't need to oppose it. And I don't need to hold on to it. So I become dispassionate about it. I allow it. So it's very spacious allowing. If you become aware of your thought and you don't fight the thought and you don't have to understand the thought, and there are times you do have to understand it, I'm not saying that you don't, but if you're driving and you just want to enter that attentiveness, just see the thought has happened.
But should there be effort in trying to stop thinking? Because I find that if I stop thinking, it's very helpful. So, but is that correct? Just try to not think, just try to be?
Isn't it more like trying to just letting it go, letting it pass?
That's definitely one approach, is to just see it and let it pass through. All right, like I explained to Colleen tonight, thoughts arise in our zazen, and they're like clouds passing in front of the sun. We don't worry about the cloud because it doesn't put the sun out. The sun appears to go out because the thought's there, and before I was just clear. Now the thought is there, and it's creating an emotion. But I realize that the sun never goes out, that the essence, what the thought is made of, which is mind, so is still there.
It's recognizing it actually as thought as opposed to reality, in a way.
Actually, you might put it the other way around, that it's reality. You know, there's a reality side to it. It presents, it is, all right? So reality is, the thought is. It has a configuration, and that configuration is the result of causes and conditions that led to that moment. So if we know that, and we know that it's happened, the thought has happened, we don't need to do anything about the thought. We can return to just observing it as another example of is, of presenting. Not different from a sound, not different from something passing in front of your eyes. So this is the beginning of dispassion. Now reactions will happen. They too are just presenting. Now one technique that's used in Zen is to work with a koan, and that helps you to have something to anchor to. So you hold on to the koan, and then you just see these things passing, but your mind is focusing on one thought. So that's one technique. But another technique that I think is very valuable is this walking meditation. It's very, very valuable. So we do this sitting, we enter this deep place, this intimate place, then we come out and we let go of, unless you're working with a koan where you keep it going as a constant stream, you let go of the count, you let go of watching your breath, You experience your actual physical walking. All right? So this is beginning to practice and show you how to be in the world of change and sensory experiences, buffeted left and right. You just stay with the experience. Thoughts arise, but they don't mean anything. You just let them go. They're just like the sensory experience. The walking has no particular meaning. But what you do is you become the walking. Now, here's the strange thing. I say become the walking, but you already are the walking. So you just drop any attempt to understand it, to figure it out, to give it any meaning. You enter the experience of walking, which is what you are already doing. So it's a kind of non-doing. It's opening a space for it. It's not creating anything. It's not understanding anything. It's not knowing anything. You already are walking. That's how simple it is. It's very difficult for especially our Western, highly trained, intelligent minds to be really simple about things. There are many times in our life where we can't be simple. We must. Some people here are learning how to be a nurse. Some people are practicing medicine. Some people are learning, you know, working as a vet or learning engineering or teaching astronomy. You have to use your mind in very complex ways, and that is not a problem. That's fine too. But how about just simply experiencing? How about walking down the street, feeling the wind on your face, hearing the birds? Are we able to do that too? That's where we rejuvenate ourselves. That's where we come back to our center. That's what restores us. That's what brings reality back to our life. And we leave the cloud in the realm of thinking and model making. So this kinhin is not unimportant. It's not to just stretch your legs. It does do that. But it's to maintain this spacious awareness while you're walking. And if you can begin to really love and appreciate kinhin, like really enter it, that definitely bleeds over into your everyday life out of the zendo. So I think here, once again, this I don't know is pointing yourself towards the experience rather than understanding it, rather than strategizing, rather than having a particular way of dealing with it. Now, there are times when certain very difficult emotions and thoughts arise. And I don't think that psychotherapy is unhelpful. I think certain types of psychotherapy are exactly like this process. They're helping you see more clearly that this thought led to an emotion which led to a presumption. And the presumption got held like a belief, all right? So it's just like our zazen. It's just working with specific things that are blocking us. Very, very useful. But in our Zen, we just get even more basic and simple than that. First of all, we just embrace. It doesn't matter if the thought or the feeling is there, no matter how painful, we just observe it, embrace it. Then we take it down into our deepest center. We realize that this is absolutely intimate. And what is that center now? See, now we've taken it into the center, realize it's intimate, we realize that it happened already, there's nothing to do about it right now. What's this center? Start to turn the attention to a deeper place, the source from which this is coming, the source from which thoughts arise. Okay, that's the power of this practice. It happens naturally. I'm pointing it out, but I don't want it to become a system in your mind. Just understand that that's the direction we move. That's kind of the essence of this practice at this point. When we really, really get comfortable there, the practice does help us come out into the world of differentiation and see it in a different way. But that's not important right now. Any other questions? Maybe another 2 or 3 minutes. Now, the nice thing about Zazen is that these things that hang us up in the world do not arise in Zazen. They arise in Zazen. Matter of fact, they arise more starkly. As we stop our busyness and our distractions, all the ways in which we are multitasking, the deeper issues, the themes of thinking, come up very clearly. So it becomes a laboratory for you to just be dispassionate about it. So Zazen is extremely helpful in this regard. Not so much in understanding and figuring things out, but in learning how to open up a space for them and not get stuck on them, and let them come in and let them go out. They arise. They arise for everybody. But you can continue that thought, fight that thought, analyze that thought, and go deeper and deeper into the morass, the quicksand, or you can just observe it, just like the smell of incense passing through as you hold your mind on that center. So that's one of the very wonderful, powerful things about Zazen, is that it enables us. Another thing it does, it enables us to experience temporary, non-injurious physical pain. So we can learn how to, you know, if you have pain in your knee, see that pain without the old habitual reaction to the pain, the rejecting reaction, and all the compensations around that. Just to leave it very, very open. So it's a really powerful laboratory. The important thing is to just do the practice and not try, not aim for these things, but just know, have the faith. The reason I'm saying this thing, for you to have the faith that in doing this practice, this is the natural outcome. It just naturally comes out of this practice, done over a long period of time, done properly in the right direction, which is why it's important to have guidance. So I think we've reached the end of our time, and we'll say the four vows. And do we have a copy for Colleen?
Mm-hmm.